Welcome to Kidney Talk, a program of Renal Support Network, a show that streams health, happiness, and hope to the kidney community. You can download all Kidney Talk shows from iTunes and find a variety of resources to help you navigate this illness at rsnhope.org. Please welcome your host, Lori Hartwell, who has lived with kidney disease since the age of two.
Well, welcome to Kidney Talk, everyone. Today we have a very special guest. It's a fellow kidney warrior, Vanessa Evans, who is a passionate advocate and who has been on dialysis for, let's just think about this for a second, 28 years. She was diagnosed at 12 years old, and she uses her lived experience to support others and amplify voices. Today, she's a director of patient advocacy and communities at Fresenius Medical Care, a dedicated mom, wife, and community leader. So welcome to the show, Vanessa.
Thank you, Lori. It's so great to be back here with you. I'm actually going on my 29th year of dialysis. So in it to win it, I like to say.
Well, you know, tell us a little bit about when, you know, when you're 12, I relate to having kidney disease at that age. And how did you find out? How did you deal with it? What was even available at that time? Because there wasn't, you know, options change all the time.
Right. So I found out when I was 12 that I was going to need a kidney transplant. And probably like you, Lori, I didn't really think too much about it because I just thought, oh, I just get a kidney transplant and life goes on. I did not understand that this was going to be the rest of my life and what this actually meant at all. I don't know, maybe my naivety has served me all my life, but I found out when I was 12, I didn't think too much about it because I really just thought, well, what big deal? I get a kidney transplant and then life goes on. I was lucky that my mom was a match for me. So when I was 18 years old, I did get a kidney transplant. That was literally the year that I graduated high school. And that's actually when I really understood what actually was happening, because I did not understand at all what was going on. I really just thought like, oh, I just got a transplant and then life will go on.
So from age 12 to 18, did you just have to take blood pressure and like limit your sodium or...
I actually had literally no symptoms of kidney disease. I am not a diabetic. I don't have lupus. I don't have high blood pressure. The way that my kidney disease was discovered was I had to do a blood test like you normally do to go to school. They saw that my hematocrit was low. They gave me iron. The iron did not help. And so they started to explore like, well, how is her hemoglobin so low? Like, what is going on? I had a bunch of blood tests and then they ended up basically, you know, testing the kidneys. And I found out then that I had a kidney problem. And I was probably then going into eighth grade or somewhere around that age. And so, no, I never had to limit or do anything because I actually felt totally fine. Even up till I got the kidney transplant, I felt fine. I never felt sick.
Wow. Well, you know what? When you're a child, you really do adapt. That's one thing that I, as a child, I adapted to all these situations. And then as I get older, I'm like, oh my goodness, it's hard to adapt.
Yeah.
And you do think you're a little indestructible too. So those teenage hormones kick in a little bit because of that. So so you got a transplant from your mom at, when you were 18. How did that go?
So for the first couple of years, it went really well. I got a transplant. I was out of the hospital within 2 weeks. But that's really when I understood that this was going to be a life-changing moment because I never was on any medicine and I was never feeling sick. So I kind of went from what I thought was normal, right?
Right.
And maybe it wasn't normal, but it was normal for me, to then being on all these immunosuppressants, not always necessarily feeling the best, even though the kidney was doing great. And one of the biggest side effects for me, and I think patients that are young probably can relate to this, is I gained a bunch of weight, right, from all the immunosuppressants. I was always very little, you know, kind of thin. and I gained maybe 20 pounds. It was right before I went to college, and I did not feel like myself at all. Like, I would look at myself in the mirror and I'm like, who is that person? Because that, I didn't recognize myself. And so that in itself became a little depressing, because that social emotional piece, nobody spoke to me about it. Nobody told me I was going to be on these immunosuppressants for the rest of my life and what it was going to actually make me feel like, make me look like, and that whole piece of it. And so it took me probably a good year to get that under control and look and feel better. But that first year, even though like everything was great kidney wise, like I was not necessarily great.
Well, the prednisones will mess with you, man. I mean, I'm like,
that's an understatement. Yes.
It's pretty comical, but if I ever have to have steroids or something like that, just keep me away from shopping. Because
right.
You make decisions that aren't always good for you. That's for sure. And so how long did that kidney last? And, you know, I want to hear a little bit about, you have such a powerful story of home hemodialysis. I want to spend more time on that. But I also want to learn about your children and how you met your husband and how all that came in what order.
Well, the kidney transplant, unfortunately, only lasted about 5.5 years. And it should have lasted way longer. The reason it did not is because when I was in the hospital and had my kidney transplant, I did have a seizure, actually two. And when I had the seizures, they put me on a medicine, Tegretol. And for the first year, I was on a bunch of immunosuppressants plus the Tegretol. And they slowly weaned me off the Tegretol because I didn't have any more seizures, but they did not lower my immunosuppressant. And my understanding, and I'm not a medical doctor, but my understanding is that the immunosuppressants then in turn were basically too high and they poisoned the kidney, the transplanted kidney, because the immunosuppressant was not lowered. And so I eventually lost the kidney. And that is when I ended up on dialysis for the first time.
Wow. So how did you pick that choice?
Well, I didn't really pick it. It just kind of happened. That was another learning experience because, again, nobody talked to me about it. And I thought, oh, I understood that dialysis was 3 days a week. I did understand that. I don't think I really understood that it was for the rest of my life or until I get another kidney, which I didn't think was going to be so hard. And I also thought that like I could pick the days and times that I wanted to go. So I thought like, oh, I can go Monday at like 9 a.m. and, you know, then maybe I can go Tuesday. Like I didn't understand the schedule at all until then. I was actually in a clinic and I'm like, oh my God, I have to do this, you know, Monday, Wednesday, Friday. I was working. I had just graduated college. So the kidney kind of did get me through college, which was great. But then when I got my first job, I was working in finance. I was working in Boston. I had to quit that job. I was living with roommates. I had to like quit living with roommates. I had to move back in with my parents and basically start dialysis. And that was my job, Monday, Wednesday, Friday.
So it's tough. It's tough also because when you go to the center, and this is what, you know, I did PD for 9 years and I did home hemo for a year. And it's sad because a lot of older people are on the end of their life. Mm-hmm. And when you go in center, you have to witness a lot of people on the end of their life and the fire department coming and the ambulance coming. And, yeah. You know, it's just, it's sad. It can be very sad. You know, I can see how that could have an impact from going from being in a college environment to in center. So how did you learn about home dialysis?
Well, it was very sad for me. You know, first of all, I was definitely the youngest person. I don't even think I was 21 yet. I had just graduated college, so maybe 20s. And you know how this is, Lori. You know, one day Valerie's there and the next day Valerie's not there. And where is Valerie? And Valerie was the person you spoke with. I saw a lot of people pass away in front of me or be there one day and then not be there the next. It's quite emotional as a young person. Yeah. I mean, I'm getting emotional thinking about it. I think of one person in particular who is an older lady who was, she passed away and was very impactful. During that time, as you get older, it probably gets a little harder, but I was young. And so, yeah, that was difficult. And what ended up happening is I met my husband. And you go through this thing when you're younger, like, who's going to want to date me? I'm on dialysis. And, you know, I come with a bunch of baggage. Like, it's really hard. But I did meet a wonderful man. His name is Paul. Paul and I got married. And I moved to another area in Massachusetts. And I had to start in center at a new clinic, which, by the way, is hard in itself, just transferring out of one clinic to another.
It's very hard.
Right? And so I did do that. And Paul and I wanted to start a family. And you and I could do a whole other podcast on this because we did. We used a gestational surrogate and we went through to have both of our boys. But when my first son was born, I felt like I was missing every milestone. You know, we waited forever to have a child. And we went through, again, I could do another podcast on this, like how we got our surrogate, how many we went through, how many times we did IVF, et cetera, et cetera. And when he was born, I felt like I was missing everything because it didn't matter, you know, if he took his first steps or he didn't sleep through the night or he was eating solid. You know, the next day I had to go to dialysis and then I would come home and I was physically exhausted. And so I wanted to find a better way to do dialysis. And Lori, nobody talked to me about PD dialysis. Nobody actually talked to me about home dialysis. I think I researched online, just kind of looking for a better way.
Well, and you know, what's interesting to me, why do you think your doctor at the time didn't tell you? Because is it because he didn't offer it?
I mean, honestly, it could have been. I don't think he did. Well, actually, I know he didn't offer it. I don't know if he offered PD. I don't think he did, to be quite honest with you. I don't think he offered any home therapy.
Because that's the main reason that, you know, people don't get offered a treatment.
Right.
Is that the doctor's not familiar with it and they don't offer it.
Right.
And
right.
So, you know, that needs to change. They all need to be trained and offer all the treatments. So from switching from in-center to home, how did you, you know, go about, you have to cannulate yourself, you have to set up all your supplies. And I imagine back then, the machines were a little bit bigger than today.
So to be quite truthful, there are newer versions of the machine that I am on. I'm on the NxStage System 1 machine. It's the OG original. There are new versions. There's a great new version that's called Versi HD with GuideMe. And that kind of walks you through. There are some images that come on the screen and tell you kind of step by step what to do. That's very, very helpful, particularly with patients. And the creation of that was through the patient advocacy board that we have at Fresenius Medical Care. So that was really cool. I'm on the same version, which is fine because I know it. I love it. It's kind of, you know, tried and true.
You could do it with your eyes closed, right?
I probably could do it with my eyes closed, like backwards, you know, any obstacle because I know how to do it now. But that is not what it was like for me the first 6 months. So I want to take you back there. The first 6 months, I kept pushing off doing home. I'm like, oh, yeah, I'm going to do it. And, you know, but the weather is too cold. I don't think I should do it right now. I like to do things when the weather is warm. And I mean, I gave a million excuses. And finally, and I tell this story often, I had the best tech ever. His name was Bill. And Bill was like, Vanessa, it's been like 8 months and you're still in center. By the way, I did in center for 8 years. Okay. So it wasn't like I was in and out. I did it for a while.
And you talked to Bill a lot.
there was a lot of Bill in my life. And I was not the easiest patient because I knew who could cannulate me and who couldn't. And I used to be like, you know, yes, you can do it. You can't do it. I probably offended a lot of people in the clinic, but I knew the infiltration hurt a lot and I didn't want to be infiltrated. I did not know how to do it myself. So I needed help, right? And Bill was one of those master techs, master cannulator. He knew how to do it. And he came to me one day and he's like, why are you still here? I thought you said you were going to start doing this at home. And I basically was like, I don't think I can cannulate. And he's like, you are going to do it and we're going to start today. And I tell this story today because it's still very relevant. And what Bill did for me is basically be my mentor. And he said, you know, what you're going to start doing is I want you to just start like gathering your supplies. So when you come in, I'm not going to have your supplies to get on the machine. I want you to go get them. Right. And so they let me go get my needles, my gauze, my Band-Aid, the alcohol wipes, like all the things that you need to do treatment. So that got me familiar with that. And after we did that for a couple of weeks, he said, okay, I want you to start watching me put the needles in. And I was like, no, I don't want to watch because I would turn the other way. And he's like, you need to watch me. And not only do you need to watch me, we're going to do the guided method. Do you know what the guided method? You probably know what the guided method is.
Yes.
So for those listening, it's basically I put my hand on top of Bill's. And Bill actually was cannulating, but I was learning how to do the cannulation. And that did a lot of things. First of all, it made me watch, which I never watched. Second of all, it made me get used to the motion of putting the needles in. And we did that for like 2 or 3 weeks, and he would go in different spots and I would, you know, get the supplies and then I would prepare like I'm going to cannulate, but Bill would cannulate. And then came the day where Bill was like, okay, it's your turn. You're going to cannulate. And I'm like, no, not ready. I need to still watch you. And he said 4 words to me that changed the trajectory of my life, which was, I believe in you. He's like, I believe in you, Vanessa. I'm right here. It's going to be okay. I know you can do this. Let's do it. And I just needed that like validation. I needed to know that he was there, and I did it. And then once I did it, I was like, oh my God, like this is not as hard as I thought it was. Like for 8 years, I thought I can't do this, and I could have been doing it the whole time. So I think one of the things we don't do a good job is helping the patients be a part of their treatment and take ownership of it. And we let everybody do everything for the patient. They take your weight, they, you know, take your temperature, they put on your blood pressure cuff, the machine is set up, everything is ready for you. Imagine if you, patient, had to do part of that when you were in center. If we started to do that a little bit, I think you would see way more people transition home, because once I got over that fear, I was like, I got this.
Well, you know what? I'm a big fan of in-center self-care.
Yeah.
And then move people to home.
Yeah.
You know, because sadly, the industry to me, and this is my opinion, is very parental. They like to be parental when it's convenient, and then it's our responsibility when it's not. And they need to have higher expectations of people. Bill really had higher expectations of you and believed in you.
He did.
And I think a lot of times, I don't know about you, Vanessa, but I've been labeled a pain in the ass because I like things a certain way, and I want to have control. And that's what helps you with a chronic illness. That's what you want. You want control. And if you have more control, you feel better. So yeah. I learned over the years, the pain in the butt survive. And, you know, I want healthcare professionals to know that, because people who are looking for control, give it to them.
Yeah, no, I understand that. And I definitely know, like I said to you, there were probably people that liked me and didn't like me, right? Because I was very much, I wanted the machine turned so I could see it, you know, and I wanted only certain people to cannulate me because I knew that they were the good ones. But I also now learned that I should have taken more control myself and asked, but you also don't know what you don't know, right?
Right.
And so
right.
I never asked those questions or even thought about it because I just thought, well, this is the way it is. And it's kind of like, well, I thought I could go Tuesday to do treatment and Friday. And I didn't know a lot of things, which now looking back on, I wish I understood more.
Well, and the longer you're in this industry, the less you know.
Right.
That's what I've learned. Like, I'm like, oh my God, there's so many other things I need to learn.
Right.
And you just never stop learning. And
true.
That's what I think is the sign of somebody who really is an advocate. They always want to learn more because there's a whole new side of, you know, preventative medicine. There's just so much going on in health.
Yeah.
That it could help our future.
I think so. And just to add to that, Lori, I mean, one of the things that I love about, you know, the space that I work in now is trying to empower patients, right? To not only share their personal journey, because sharing their personal journey then helps a peer, right? Someone that is new to this. And then they can start to think and ask questions for their own medical journey, because we're not all the same, right? Even though you and I are both labeled with kidney disease, our paths are very different, right? And so we need to understand what are the questions to ask and when to fall back and speak to a healthcare provider or another advocate that can help you.
They use this term, patient-centered care, but patient-centered care to me means you're individual. Sometimes it doesn't mean that to other people. So I think that we have to define our meanings more. So tell us a little bit about your job and how, you know, you transitioned over to be an advocate and head of advocacy. And what do you do today? And how do you use your past experiences to help you achieve your goals?
Sure. So, you know, my journey is a long one. I started off being a Spanish teacher. I'm bilingual. My mother is Venezuelan. And when I got diagnosed with kidney disease, I gave up, you know, the job in Boston, if you will. And I had to find a job that I could do part-time, basically, and be in a clinic. And for me, it was natural to be a Spanish teacher on a part-time basis because Spanish was my minor. I spoke it at home. I understood it. So I started by doing that. Then I started to get involved in the kidney community. And I did that by volunteering to go to events and go to conferences. And slowly, I started to meet people in the industry. I was asked to speak at events. And I started to kind of understand a little bit about the business and know about the conferences. Because I didn't know anything about what conference was what. And I met people at these conferences, like I said. And one day, you know, after I've been doing this for a couple of years, by the way, and teaching Spanish, I had someone from one of the conferences say, you know, we would love to have you consult for us, right? To talk about the patient perspective. And this was back at Fresenius. And so I worked part-time basically as a consultant at Fresenius for a number of years in the home space. And I was also maintaining my job as a Spanish teacher. At that point, I actually started my own business, a Spanish immersion camp. I had a couple of teachers that worked for me. I worked at the local high school. I was consulting and I was juggling dialysis at home as well. And then that turned into NxStage calling on me. This was before Fresenius acquired NxStage. And I went to work for NxStage as one of the patient consultants who they still have today, where if you call their, you know, 888 number, you can speak with a patient consultant. So about that lived experience with home therapies. And basically, Lori, I worked my way up, right? Really from working just kind of part-time, consulting, you know, then getting a job as a manager in advocacy, and then working my way up over the last number of years. And I'm really happy that they have really recognized the power that a patient can bring to the table, having this lived experience, but also understanding the business side of things and being able to, you know, kind of take the best, if you will, of both spaces and developing that into this director of advocacy. And what that means now is I have a team of two amazing women that work on my team and about 100 advocates that go out and share their own personal experience with other interested patients and family members, because we know it's really like a full journey, about their experience with home therapies, so that when patients are diagnosed and they have a million questions like I did, there's someone they can speak with. They're not giving medical advice or clinical advice or anything like that. It's more just a shared experience, and then they can speak with their medical team to get prescriptions and answer clinical questions and all the other things that they're going to need, because it's a full, you know, it's kind of a full concierge of people that you need.
No, it is. And, you know, not everybody relates to everybody. Mm-hmm. That's one of the things that I'm a big believer in through Renal Support Network is, you know, you walk into a room and it's kind of like a bar. I don't want to say it, but you know, every bar has different flavors, restaurants, and you may not click with that person.
It's true.
And if you don't click with that person, the next room might have the place you connect with them. So you have to have more than kidney disease to make a long-term friend.
Exactly. And to be an advocate, you want to be sharing your story, which is, you know, I always say it's not all unicorns and rainbows, right? You want to be truthful. And I think it's helpful when you have someone that is, you know, maybe from your area, you can, maybe you've seen them at church or you've seen them at events. So there has to be a commonality there. We all have the commonality of kidney disease, but like you said, our past might be all very different, but it's nice to have a peer in that space that you can talk to.
And that you can develop a relationship. I'll never forget, and I tell this story a lot, but I met this girl who was a little bit older and a little bit cooler than me during a blood transfusion. And she just was able to manage kidney disease. And I was a young girl transitioning from a teenager to an adult, like I was 19 and going to be 20. And I saw her and I'm like, oh my God, she's so cool. And she's on dialysis, you know?
Yeah.
And it was so funny because I'm like, I could see myself like that. And I think so often that that's one of the reasons I created Renal Support Network is because if you're always seeing people in the dialysis waiting room, it's not a true sense of all the people. And I remember when I had my first two transplants that didn't work, my first one at 13 and second one at 17, you just put me in a dialysis waiting room, I could scare the crap out of the other patients,
right,
telling them my horror stories. And so if you're looking for experience of certain, you don't go, like if you're in an in-center dialysis unit, you might find somebody that was on home hemo, but it's not going to be a good experience because they're back in center.
Yeah.
And so it's kind of a, you know, a confirmation bias. So I always tell people that. It's like you got to be in the place where you'll hear all the stories and make sure you're open to hearing everything. Because if you're going to one place, you're not hearing the full scope.
Yeah, I think that's really important and good advice. And then the patient needs to do their own personal research on, you know, what's right for them. And unfortunately, I still think to this day, like patients don't necessarily do that. They end up in a clinic. So that might be what it is. But there is a lot of opportunity to go home if you wanted to find out about transplant, if that's something. And now there's new machines that are, you know, coming to the clinic. We talked a little bit about the HDF experience now that's coming to the United States with that 5000 ADEX care system, which I'm happy that patients are having more choices.
More options.
More options.
Well, I would not be true to myself if I didn't say Critline.
Yeah.
So,
yeah, the Critline. That's important.
I'm a big fan of it, and I hope someday that it's more of a standard of care.
Yeah.
I really do.
It is in the 5000 ADEX. The Critline is all part of that new HDF machine.
Well, patients need to learn it because I know that there's one problem, and as an advocate, I'd love to hear your experience. There's a little bit of learned helplessness going on because I always talk about this, that, you know, patient says it's cold in the clinic and then the provider says, you know, sorry, nothing we can do about it. So, you know, just bring a blanket. And I think that we have to be really careful how we answer people because of the fact that they're telling you how they feel. And if you say, oops, sorry, and nothing we could do about it, bring a blanket, I think you need to explain to them why they're cold. They have blood out of their body, and their hemoglobin's low. And, and you know, we have to set a temperature that's good for everybody in the clinic, not just for them sitting in the chair. Everybody else would quit. and you know, because I think it fosters learned helplessness. When you don't explain the why or take the time and then tell them how to solve the problems, like make sure you look at your labs and ask your doctor about it, what makes you cold, and you know, support them taking charge. Because at a point when somebody asks a question, that you may not think is relevant, they decide that they have stupid questions and they don't ask them anymore. And I've seen this over and over again. So, I mean, I feel sad a lot of times because I think there are no stupid questions. And patients should just ask them. But sometimes they're made to feel stupid.
Yes, and that's shameful. And we certainly don't want to do that. And I couldn't agree with you more on understanding why you feel cold and what it is. I mean, even now, you know, when I do my therapy here at home, I can feel cold. Now, the comfort of my own home, right? I can turn the heat up. I can make it as toasty as I want it to be. But that being said, you should understand metabolically, right, what is going on. And unfortunately, that doesn't necessarily always happen. And so understanding the why is important.
Yes. And I think that, you know, but it takes time. And so for everybody listening, if a question like, you know, just come online, come on to Kidney Talk or come on to one of the boards and just ask it, why do I feel so cold and what can I do about it? And, you know, and learn for yourself and ask your doctor. Because, you know, when I did home, I had my black poodle in my lap. And so that kept me extra warm.
a nice little snuggle.
A little snuggle and covered under. I mean, the cold is really debilitating at times.
It actually can be.
And I don't want to ever dismiss that. Like, maybe it's helping us live longer because they say if you submerge into ice water, you live longer.
Maybe.
I don't know.
I don't know. I'm going to say that, yes, that could be true. You know, it's funny, you're making me laugh because even now when I do my treatment, you can see maybe behind, I have these doors behind me. And when somebody comes in, inevitably they leave the door kind of more open. And I'm always like, shut the door behind you, shut the door behind you. I could just play a little recording of myself saying that because I like it cozy warm. And, you know, any little opening lets a little bit of that air back in and I like it nice and warm. But yeah, you're right. We should talk about all those pieces.
Well, now give us an update. Are you planning on ever getting a transplant?
So I am highly sensitized. My antibodies, so for those of you listening, this might be something that you may or may not understand. As you get transplants, your sensitivity to a new kidney may go up. Your titers go up, right? And so my antibodies are very high, basically at 100%, 99.9, if not 100%. That makes it increasingly more difficult for me to get a kidney transplant. And that is why I also am blood type O positive. So I can give to everybody, but I can only get from O. So that also makes it doubly hard. So the chances of me getting a kidney is like 1 in 1,000,000. I am very difficult to match. If anybody listening out there wants to try to donate, still always trying to take donations.
Are you listed?
Well, I am listed. I'm listed at Mass General in Boston. Yeah. I will say, though, there are new opportunities that have come my way for clinical trials, but I do not feel like I want to do a clinical trial right now because I do very well, knock on wood, with dialysis at home. I have to dialyze 5 days a week for, you know, 3-4 hours each night. So it's part of my life and I would like a transplant. So the answer is yes, Lori, I would like a transplant. Yes, I am listed at Mass General. However, I'm hard to find a match and doing the clinical trials. I'm so happy that they're doing them. Wonderful. I just don't feel like I want to put myself in that position because I don't feel like I need to be there yet.
You know, my dog is barking right now. He's telling you to go do it. Well, Vanessa, we have a little bit more in common than you think. This is my fourth transplant, but I was 100% antibodies and I am negative O blood. Huh. And so I've been transplanted 15 years. So wow. We'll have to talk offline. Not all antibodies are equal. You know, luckily, the antibodies I had through Cedars-Sinai, and I have another podcast on this, was able to knock them down a bit with a living donor, which was really good. And my creatinine's 0.8.
Amazing.
So it's pretty amazing, and it's been 15 years. And then also, there's some new science in transplant because somebody who had better antibodies to me was actually B positive. And the B, they can change the blood type too.
Well, that I know. Anyway, let's talk offline because I do have questions
yeah,
for you.
Yeah, let's talk offline about that. But I think it's hopeful. And, you know, it is hard to transition because I had those two transplants that didn't work. It was awful. It takes you out of the game for a while. Why don't we wrap up? So what are your future goals? And tell us a little bit how your kids are doing and your family.
Well, those two boys that we talked about earlier in the podcast that we did with a surrogate, one is 21 now, and he's a junior in college. The other one is 19, and he's a freshman in college. And I have to say, you know, neither of my boys, they don't know me besides being a Vanessa mom on dialysis, right? They've only seen their mom on dialysis, so it's very normal for them to see me not only doing my treatment, but I take it with me, obviously, when we go away or, you know, whatever we do. You know, the future of me wants to continue to feel as healthy as I can. Even being a dialysis patient for 29 years, I'm pretty healthy. You know, I can walk miles. Believe it or not, I play pickleball. I work full time. You know, I try to keep myself busy. It's definitely gotten harder as I've gotten older. I feel it. I'm more tired. So I'd like to get the transplant. I think you trade one thing in for another, but I think I'm ready for a trade. But, you know, I'm just hoping to stay as healthy and as positive as I can be for the next 30 years, right? And that's how I see it, day by day, keeping positive every day.
Well, and it's exciting because more people are adapting to home dialysis too. And I think today that people need to understand that if you take on your own care, you're better off everywhere because nobody's in charge of your care like you are. You're in charge of your care 24 hours a day.
Right.
And that is so important to longevity. And before we wrap up, I want to ask one quick thing because I think it's important. How do family dynamics play in somebody choosing home?
That's a really good question. As a matter of fact, we at Fresenius just did like a webinar about this with some people that work, you know, in the field because everybody looks at this very differently, right? I've had a lot of patients say to me, I don't want to bring this home. I don't want to bring dialysis at home and make it clinical and be worried about this and that. And I want my family to look at me normally. I guess I had a different mindset. I honestly didn't think about it because I brought dialysis home basically when my now 21-year-old son was just born. So like we made it very normal. It wasn't like, oh, mommy's on dialysis, be careful, or oh, your mom she's not going to have a long life. We never made it a thing. We made it like, oh, let's go watch TV while mom does dialysis. Or, you know, I did it when they were at school or whatever it is. And so my family has gotten very accustomed to it. I'll tell you a quick story because I know we're running out of time. When I first did dialysis at home, I thought I wanted to be in a separate room by myself, like didn't have it in front of everybody, you know? And what I actually learned, and this was for me, and it might be very different for other people, but what I learned is, oh my God, I'm like sitting in a room by myself while everybody else is in the family room watching a movie or talking. I feel left out. So I moved dialysis into our family room. And so it continues to be here. So when there's a big game on, everybody comes and watches it with me because we're big sports people here. You know, my supplies, they get it. They're here. It's just a part of everything that we do. And I never made it a big deal. So I really feel like it's how you portray it. And if you can somehow find it in your strength. And also I had the most supportive husband ever that allowed me to do it at home and wanted me to be the healthiest that I could and knew that a home therapy was going to be that. And he wanted me to be healthy. And so I had a great support. And that allowed me to do it and allows me to continue to do it. So it was never a big deal for us.
So I know everybody is thinking, where did you meet your husband?
I met him through a friend. Yeah. Old school. I met him through a friend, and he worked with, you know, someone that she was dating, and that was it. We met each other and dated for a couple of years and have been married now 20 plus years. Yeah.
Wow. That's wonderful.
Thank you.
Congratulations. You're Thanks. Such an inspiration.
So are you.
And well, I know we just keep on sharing the journey, and I look forward to learning more about your patient advocacy. And, you know, home dialysis is better. I chose PD over home hemo.
Which is a great therapy as well, too.
I mean, yes, definitely.
Yeah.
But, you know, sometimes you can't do, I had to do home hemo while I was getting a transplant.
Sure.
And because I didn't want any surgeries in my stomach or, you know, any PD while I was trying to get that transplant. So you do whatever you can to stay well. So I appreciate, Vanessa, your time, your expertise, and your friendship. So we'll see you again and talk a little bit about some other topics we spoke about.
That sounds great. I look forward to it. Thanks for inviting me and having me.
Thanks for listening to Kidney Talk, a program of Renal Support Network. Please make sure to find us on Facebook or sign up for our newsletter at rsnhope.org. Kidney Talk is intended for informational purposes only. It is not intended to be a substitute for professional medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment from your physician. Always seek the advice of your own healthcare provider regarding your medical condition.